use technology to strengthen your faith. Follow our tweets at twitter.com/faithtalk1500.
A week ago on March the 30th, we celebrated, I say celebrated, we marked 30 years since the assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan. March the 30th, 1981 is when that took place. You know, time flies so rapidly. I was thinking it had only been 20 years, but no, 30 years since that assassination attempt, John Hinckley attempting to kill the president as he emerged after a brief speech at the Washington Hilton Hotel. The man widely credited with saving the life of President Ronald Reagan that day was the Secret Service agent in charge of his detail, Jerry Parr, who is on the other end of our phone line. And Mr. Parr, it is an honor once again to be able to chat with you. I hope you're well.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, it's a beautiful day here in Washington, and I'm glad to talk to you.
Talk to me about that day, March the 30th. You weren't even supposed to be on the detail that day out there at the Washington Hilton.
Yes, that's true. And an agent, Johnny Guy, was the agent that was supposed to go, but I hadn't been actually very close to the president because I had been with Jimmy Carter up to the inauguration day. And even though I went through the inauguration ceremonies with him, I got sent to some management school for about 3 or 4 weeks. And my deputy took over, and I just wanted to ride with him on what I thought was going to be a routine trip.
Yeah, I think most people forget that the president, Ronald Reagan, had only been president several weeks when he was shot.
This is true. About 70 days, actually, he had been president. And so we just took this routine trip. We had the road and the highway and the security. Everything was secure, and we went there. And as we were leaving, then the gunfire started. So.
Yeah. What was, I don't know, can you remember 30 years ago when you first heard the sounds of the gunfire?
This is something, Paul, that I will remember all of my life. I think it's like soldiers in combat. You hardly ever forget the moment that an event started. And what I remember is that we were walking toward the car, and my number one agent, actually in a diamond formation, he had opened the door because it was raining a little bit that day, and we were walking toward that door, and a person yelled out from some direction, "Mr. President," and then I heard two shots, and then four other shots very rapidly, and then I immediately responded to that first shot by grabbing the president's left shoulder with my left hand, and my right hand went up toward the middle of his back, up closer to his neck. And Ray Shattuck, who was my shift leader, he and I gave the president a tremendous heave into the car. Now, those shots have been measured. So you have all six shots fired in 1.7 seconds, and the door is shut. Because, I mean, my feet are hanging out, and Ray Shattuck throws our feet in. And by the time that door shut, it's 3 seconds from the first shot till the door is shut. And I yell for the driver to move out rapidly.
And he did. So rapidly. So
rapidly,
in fact, he's all alone. There's no longer a motorcade. You're out there all alone.
That's right. But we have a plan for that. It's called the escape package. And it's consisted of four cars. The armored car, we had an armored Lincoln, is off the record car. It didn't look armored, but it was armored to use in case our main car, which was 200X, failed. And not far from you people there in Detroit is 200X and also 100X, in which President Kennedy was killed in.
Right.
And so that car is not far from people to take a look at. It's a very large car, 21 and a half feet long, and when it was fully armored, it weighed 6.5 tons, 13,000 pounds.
Wow.
So that's what's moving down the, essentially alone for about the first 35 seconds. And then we picked up our follow-up car, and Marianne Gordon, our transportation agent, in the spare car, along with Dr. Ruge, and then a car driven by a sergeant from the military office with the deputy person for the president, Mike Deaver, who's passed away by now, and
right.
also a guy named Dave Fisher, who is a scheduler. So in a way, we were moving down the highway, and we were moving toward the White House south on Connecticut Avenue. And about DuPont Circle, I was kneeling in front of him, and because this car is very large, the jump seats were pushed back to the back of the front seat, so it'll give us a lot of room. And so when I moved away from the scene, I could see three bodies on the sidewalk and a bullet hole in the window. Obviously, it had been some kind of an attack on the president, and one never knows, if you're the agent in charge, whether this is a group attack, whether it's going to be a decapitation strike against all the leaders in government. You just don't know. The Cold War was raging at that time, so I was aware of all that stuff. But about DuPont Circle, that means about 30 to 35 seconds into the run back to the White House. Just before that, I made a cursory examination with my bare hands under the president's coat, up from his belt line, up his sides, up his back, in his armpit area, the back of his neck, the head, and ran my hands through his hair. I got no blood on my hands. And that's when I radioed back to Ray Shattuck that Rawhide was okay, that we were headed back to Crown, which is the code name for the White House in those days. Now, about DuPont Circle, he reached into his right pocket and pulled out a napkin from the hotel, and he said, "I think I've cut the inside of my mouth." Now, what I saw was a copious amount of blood, bright red, frothy. And we had this course called 10-minute medicine. All the agents had it. And the thrust of this course was to be able to keep anybody alive for at least 10 minutes until you could get proper medical attention. And when I saw that frothy red blood and the amount of it, I just made a quick decision. We're going to GW Hospital. It was on our way back to cross Pennsylvania Avenue. We'd go to the White House, make a right turn. You're six blocks from GW, which is a first-rate trauma room. We all knew that. So that route had been run previously that morning by Marianne Gordon and all the drivers that are in that escape package, because we like the agents to have seen the route and what it looks like. You know, sometimes in Washington, you can have a road tore up. So as we make this turn, we're headed right to that circle. And I remember the driver saying to me, "Do you want to go the wrong way around the circle?" Which would have put us head on with some traffic maybe coming in to Washington, down Pennsylvania Avenue. So I said, "No, go around the circle." And we pulled in there. And on the radio transcripts, I misspoke one word. I said, "Get an ambulance out there." What I meant to say was, "Get a stretcher out there." Mm-hmm. What I didn't know was that he wanted to walk in. So when we arrived, the two agents with Uzis surround the car. Ray Shattuck comes up and opens the door. I back out and stand up and extend my hand to him. But he doesn't want to take it. He really didn't want to take it. So I said, "All right, come on, let's come on out." And so he came on out. And as we walk in, Shattuck steadies him on the right side because he's a little weak, and he looked bad because he looked sort of gray and purple around and blue around the lips. So I felt that something had happened, and I thought maybe I'd broken a rib on the impact coming in on top of him, flattened him out. And the reason we do that is that we don't know what's across the street. And so we try to keep him covered at all times until that door is shut. Anyway, he walked in about maybe 15 to 20, 25 feet. His eyes rolled back in his head, and he just dropped like a lead balloon or a footlocker falling out of an airplane. But we kept his head from hitting the floor by holding his shoulders up. But he was very heavy, must have weighed close to 200 pounds in those days. And we got some help from the agents around us and an ambulance driver who just happened to be standing there. And we carried him to trauma table 5 and laid him on the gurney. And that's when I looked at him, I thought for sure he was going to die. Because this nurse said no blood pressure. I think she said low, but I'm always been positive that she said no. And it could have very well been true because he had lost so much blood in his left lung. He was actually drowning in his left lung. And what we didn't know was that he'd been hit by a ricocheting bullet. And that's essentially the story, because we set up a security perimeter immediately with the agents that we had. The 4 to 12 shift, which was coming in, which was composed of about seven or eight agents. They augmented us that were there, we were there. And then the whole Washington field office and the uniform division, and within half an hour, there must have been 300 agents and uniformed people surrounding that hospital and making it a secure place, like the whole White House had been moved down there from six blocks away. So that's just essentially the whole story.
Former Secret Service agent Jerry Parr, my guest here on the Paul Edwards program. He's the man you have seen numerous times if you've watched the newsreels of the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan 30 years ago on March the 30th, 1981. He is the man directly behind President Reagan, pushing him into the limousine and then covering him with his body. Just 2 weeks or so ago, we here in Detroit, along with the rest of the country, watched you on a CNN special out at the Henry Ford Museum, where President Reagan's limousine is. You told me a week or so ago when we talked privately that, that was actually filmed last December. What was it like for you, Jerry Parr, to be back there in front of that car and to see it again?
Well, Paul, I tell you, I hadn't seen it in at least maybe 10, 15 years. They used it. They continued to use it after the event because it was really our best car. And what's unusual about this car is it was the only one we owned with what is known as a Continental style of door opening. That door opened toward Hinckley. And with McCarthy's big Irish body there guarding and standing up and doing a courageous thing by just standing there, and he took one of the shots that would have either hit me or the president, clearly. Because he got hit and he went down rapidly. By that time, we were past Tim and we were going in, and that's when one of those shots hit the window. Now, we did that in December. And when I looked at that space down there, I kept staring into it silently. We were gonna reenact it with Drew Griffith, the anchor man who was with us that night that we did it. And I was going to push Drew to a spot where he would look like he was going in, but they didn't want us to actually go into the car. But that's essentially what I did. But my instincts were, my goodness, we've got two cars here, 200X, where a president almost died, and we got 100X right behind it, where a president did die. Essentially, he died. His heart was still beating, but when Clint Hill got to that car on that fateful day in November of 63, he missed a step, but he got to it, and then he jumped and got Jackie back in there and looked down in one of the most awful things that I think any man could see from the Secret Service or anyone. The president's side of his head above his right ear was just gone. Brains and blood and all these terrible things were all over the place, all over the street, all over the trunk, and this is what he's carried with him for the last 47 years. Well, I knew about that kind of thing because I had been assigned in New York when John Kennedy came up there. And so that became, that film of that Zapruder took, became a very iconic figure, thing for me. I always carried it in my mind about what the possibilities were as an agent in charge or even working. The people that I have had worked, like I worked three Democrats, I worked three Republicans. And so when something like that had happened, I responded with what I call muscle memory. And our training, which began essentially for this, was in the mid-70s. And what we did was we practiced with somebody playing the part of the president under all kinds of circumstances, behind podiums, walking rope lines, getting into cars, being pulled back if you were close enough to the building you came at. In other words, you were trying to shield him. At the most, you would shield him with your body. But if you had to, you could pull him back into the building. So you used every kind of thing to shield the president's body from harm, and that's what we basically did that day.
What was your relationship like, Jerry, with the president? I mean, we've already established that 70 days into Ronald Reagan's presidency, he's got the full 8 years ahead of him. How long were you with him? How often did you see him? And what was your relationship with the president like after that?
Well, you know, it was we were bonded. I mean, I wanted to bond with him, but not necessarily politically. I mean, we're sort of not immune to it. Of course, we can vote for anybody we want to, but what happened was we got bonded in a way that I didn't realize was going to happen. In the late 30s, there was a movie that came out called The Code of the Secret Service, and the main character was an agent named Brass Bancroft. Well, he was played by Ronald Reagan. So after this event, I don't think he knew about this until I told him later in the car when I was working that year, 1981, that I admired that movie, and that's why I got in the Secret Service. I said, who would have thought that 42 years later we would be in his car running to the hospital? And he said, you know, Jerry, he said, it was the worst movie I ever made. On the other hand, it was one that inspired me to do what I did. So you can't tell how God works.
Well, let's talk about how God works, because now you find yourself in almost a ministry position. You leave the Secret Service, and now you are in a position of leadership over God's people, aren't you?
Well, I did get ordained into the gospel ministry of Jesus Christ in the Festival Church, which is one of six or seven faith communities that came out of the original Church of the Savior, founded by Gordon Cosby, who was a chaplain in the 101st Airborne Division in World War II. And he went through a whole lot. And if you read the book called A Commitment by Elizabeth O'Connor, you can see all what happened to Gordon. But we became interested in that church. And we joined this church. Actually, it was the Jubilee Church, and I got ordained after about a 2 or 3 year program. We got ordained, and we were all into small churches. We don't have an edifice complex, but I was interested in your preview here when you talked about the community or your inner city bookstore, because we have one too. It's the Potter's House Church. Bookstore, and it's been around since 1960, so it may be a little older than yours.
Yeah.
But we still sell books. We still, you know, do ministry around the area, but we have a lot of ministries, and we do things with the homeless and people with mental problems and people who are dying of AIDS. It's a full ministry if we can, education, housing, and those things like that. But we never have had more than 500 people. But they are focused. And so there's a focus there. And I do remember, Paul, going up to him just before he was taken away to the operating room. I looked him right in the eye. He had just got this thing on. And he'd already tried out a line with me. He said, he looked right at me. There was another agent in there, Dale McIntosh is his name. He said, I don't think he said Jerry. He said, I hope they're all Republicans, said to nobody in particular, but he was looking at me. And I looked him right in the eye and said, Lord, don't let him die. Don't let him die. And I said that with all the fervor I could. I mean, because during the whole thing of when it was happening, I didn't think about God, my wife, or anything else. I was just doing my duty that I'd been trained to do. And that's maybe what the service wanted us to do. If in an emergency, it's a muscle memory thing. It's like if you see a child run out in front of your car, you don't say, I'm going to take my right foot off the accelerator and put it on the brake. You just do it. That's muscle memory. And that's what we're trained to do. And so I did it. And it helped save his life. But I think there's another level there in happening, and it has to do with divine grace, I think.
Do you think that that God ordered your steps in such a way, Jerry Parr, that it was you and not Johnny Guy standing behind the president that day?
Well, it could be that. It could be that. I mean, I don't know God's full will, but I do think that that had a lot of God stuff going on that particular day. Yeah, I think maybe it happened. Maybe it was that way.
Talk to me just briefly before I let you go about about a month ago, I was out in California, first time I've ever been in California, and I visited the Reagan Presidential Library. I was on the president's plane, and then obviously went and visited his gravesite there. But I cannot think of Ronald Reagan without thinking of Nancy Reagan. Talk to me firsthand as a Secret Service agent about what you witnessed in their relationship, Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
Well, it was, in my opinion, the love of a lifetime. And in this new book that Del Wilber wrote, Rawhide Died, he speaks of it that way. I mean, everyone knew that she loved him dearly and really needed to get to the White House that day. And there's another agent there. I can't think of his name now. He was her chief of security, and he had to sort of control her to keep her from jumping out of the car as we went only those 6 blocks from the White House. And it was a deep love affair, and I'm sure she loved him and really probably prayed for him intensely for him to live. And you know that library is a beautiful place, isn't it? Simi Valley, California.
Have you been there?
Yeah, I have. I've been there 3 or 4 times. Yeah, before I went there the last time. Well, not the last time. Well, the last time was just only a few days ago, when we went out there to do something with the book that had just come out on what happened that day. And it has evolved over the years in a way, and his spirit is all over that place.
Yes.
He's not really, I mean, you could say his body is in that grave, but his spirit, and they've done it so well that it's really remarkable.
Yeah, everyone needs to visit the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. There's no question that the spirit of optimism and just forward-lookingness is all over the place.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And that plane, isn't it wonderful looking out there? I didn't get to go in it, but I did. I think you went through it, did you not?
I did go through it. Yes, it was very interesting.
Many an hour on that plane.
Yeah, I'm sure
did. I don't think the only time he got to ride on the great big one was when he had passed away in the casket. They flew a plane out there to pick him up.
Yeah, I was talking with a friend earlier today, and we were trying to think: was it George H.W. Bush that was the first president to have the newer models of?
I believe version. It was. I couldn't swear on a. As they say, a stack of Bibles, but I do believe that's true, that he was the first one to ride it. It's very big. You have to have 2 posts on it. I mean, you know, you have to have ages down near the place because it's so long, the distance between where we are. The press is in the very back, and then you have the agents, and then you have the staff, and then you have the VIPs, then you have the president. And so we had, I guess, they told me that they had to have another couple of posts up in front.
Jerry Parr, it's been an honor to chat with you. I appreciate it. I know you have been in great demand with the anniversary of the assassination attempt having been upon us. But we so appreciate you spending some time with us here in Detroit and sharing your story.
Well, Paul, thank you for listening to it, and the best of all luck in your missions and your what you're doing for the Lord.
Thank you very much. And I want to say to you, as I say to you every time I've talked to you, Jerry, I want to thank you for what you've done for our country.
You're quite welcome. You're quite welcome, Paul. God bless you.